The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Our panel today, Johnny Fallon is the Strategy Director at Carr Communications. Sinead O'Carroll is the editor at thejournal.ie. And Noel Rock is a former Fine Gael TD. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
And I suppose we should start with the president, and there are opinions right across the papers on this on both sides of it. Sinead, what jumped out for you?
I think probably what jumped out for me is the poll that 81% of the Irish people agree with Michael Dee that to not accept the invitation. But then there, I think because 81% of people do believe that, there is some really thoughtful pieces across the paper that I think are probably worth reading if you do hold that opinion, just to see like where there might be gaps in your nuance or gaps in the context. That
do you think you should have gone?
I'm not saying that people should change their opinion, and I'm actually swayed by different people's opinion that, like, and as Catherine Crowe, or Katrina Crowe, the archivist, would always have said about these 1916 to 1921 commemorations, that we do need to complicate the narrative.
That's a piece that
Colin Murphy has written really for The Sunday Independent, which is really good. And Colin Murphy is one of our best columnists on page 34 of
He makes a point as well. If you elect an intellectual and re-elect an intellectual, you can't blame him when he uses his intellect.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's where I land on it, that like, I don't think Michael Dee Higgins would have made this decision lightly. I don't think he would have looked at it and thought, okay, I'm not happy with the title, and I'm not happy with the fact that they call me Republic of Ireland, the President of the Republic of Ireland.
They didn't. He was referred to that subsequently by the DUP. It was addressed correctly. We should be clear on that.
I think, like, while he stated those two things, I don't think that they were the full reason that he declined the invite. So I think for that reason...
What do you think his other reasons were?
I think he probably considered it in the context and the nuances of everything that he has looked at and studied over the centenary and what is appropriate and what's not. I'm not sure if it's the fact that it was the Queen was going to be there and it felt like it was going to be given a greater emphasis on the celebratory or the commemoratory side of it rather than just marking a date. The fact that there was going to be celebrations that night in Northern Ireland, the fact that there
was... Justine McCarthy points out they were going to light up buildings and there was going to be a state reception as well.
And that's why some of the opinion pieces are really good today, because you get those kind of nuances. Yeah. So like from Colin Murphy saying we have... The esteem of President Higgins, so it cuts both ways. Justine saying that, Eilidh O'Hanlon in the Sunday Independent saying that there is a little bit or a lot of anti-Britishness in some of that 81% agreeing with them. And some of the poll will show you that Ireland thinks, Kevin Cunningham was talking today about the rise of, not the rise of nationalism, but that we are quite nationalistic, and that does come
Johnny,
into play
it is,
here.
It is surprising, isn't it, that 81% of people, according to this poll now, and it's a poll of 1,000 people, I gather, it's a mixture of face-to-face and SMS. It was done yesterday in the course of about 4 hours. But if we take that as some kind of a snapshot, it's a lot of people agree with the president.
It's a lot of people agree with him. And I think it's probably not surprising. Irish people do tend to, we like our presidents anyway. When the president's in office, we tend to agree with them because they're non-political and we see that as safe. But also it doesn't surprise me that, you know, when it comes to a situation like this, Irish people, Martin Manzer has a very good piece in the paper today about this, and they had the Business Post about it. Look, one thing about this, I think we've really got to get beyond, when we're talking about commemorations and we're talking about, like, I have to say, it drives me bananas. You just look at people and wonder, you know, the more solemn we get about these things, the more we have to step back. If you want to celebrate something, just celebrate it. Go out, have a bit of fun, and stop all this thing. Why the Queen has to be at our celebrations of the foundation of our state and make it awkward
But everyone's clear these are not celebrations. They are marking things, and they're marking very important things for different reasons. For different people, they're important.
But that's the problem. You know, that's the problem. You can start out and you can say, OK, we want to commemorate something. And this isn't just about what's happening in the North. It's about our own celebrations or commemorations or everything else. It's actually much easier when you're straight up and say, do you know what? We want to celebrate something. Makes it easier. When you move away from that and you start talking about we want to commemorate, you're getting into what I think President Higgins actually saw in this was we're getting into a dangerous grey area here where we're starting about talking about a little religious service and maybe some solemn kind of nodding and to something where some people in the North quite rightly want to celebrate the fact that that was the foundation of the Northern state. And I've no issue with that. I think they should be allowed to feel proud of that, to feel proud of their own achievements. I, on the other hand, do not want to celebrate. I don't think partition was good for Ireland.
I don't know. You know? I don't know about that. Go back to Catriona Crowe. Complicate the narrative. Like, if we're just going to have different people celebrating things in different ways, is that not just leading on to tribalism and everything? We beat on boats against the tide, borne ceaselessly into the past.
No, like,
we know
not,
that these
Brendan.
Things can lead to big upswings of various kinds of toxicity they're purely celebrated.
The reason that will happen, though, Brendan, is because people try to move along these grey areas. When we got peace in Northern Ireland was because we got governments in the south and in Britain who were able to say, listen, we're working with unionists and we're okay. We're not ashamed of being British. And an Irish government that at the time was able to say, we're not ashamed of being
Johnny,
Irish.
I'm sorry, we got peace in the north by grey areas. And they're grey areas that are coming back to bite us now in various ways, but it was creative ambiguity did
it.
It was agreeing to disagree on things and agreeing to be vague.
Looking forward. There was no ambiguity looking past. They allowed people to hold your position on the past. Whatever position you hold is fine. And you don't have to change it or revisit it. You do have to revisit the future. And that's where I think President Higgins is right. When you look forward, we need to revisit how we're all going to get along together on this island and respect traditions. That does not mean we have to revisit our positions on the past. And the Good Friday Agreement says nothing about whether partition was good,
bad, or indifferent.
I don't
think anyone has been asked. Okay, look, we could go around the houses on this. I don't think anyone has been asked to revisit their position. It was accepted that there was a danger of that
and a danger of the symbolism of that as President of Ireland, and I think he was entitled to do that.
Okay, now, someone who doesn't agree with you is on the line now. Darren McCaffrey is the political editor at GB News, and Darren is based in the UK, but Darren, you'd be from Fermanagh?
Yeah, I grew up essentially on the border, not far from Clonus, but yeah, pretty much on the border.
Okay, so.
I think my big thing is, you know, we talk about the context of all of this, and actually this is not a reference to the past. This is literally the present. The name of the service was to mark the partition of Ireland and the formation of Northern Ireland. That's clearly the case. Northern Ireland exists. And you can, by attending the service or not attending the service, is not going to get away from the reality that Northern Ireland is in existence. And this is why I think we need to see the bigger picture here. And the bigger picture clearly is, would President Higgins's attendance to the service actually fundamentally change anything? No. But is it
would
a
he be
potential...
endorsing partition, though?
President Higgins likes to say he's the president of all of Ireland. And it's really interesting that this debate about whether he should go or not has kind of been taken, you know, in the 26 counties and not in the six. If he does genuinely represent all the people of Ireland, that means having to represent unionists in the north as well. And that's why I say the bigger picture here of making this gesture, making unionists feel included in an Ireland that may well be united at some stage, that's the important bit. It's marking or celebrating the partition of Ireland. It's already happened. It happened 100 years ago. His attendance of this, or lack of attendance, is not fundamentally going to change that point. What it may well change, though, his attendance, is it may well actually be another step towards unionists and the inclusion of unionists and the feeling of inclusion of unionists in an Ireland that may well change in the decades to come. And that's the key point. It's about sending out a message to unionists that potentially in a united Ireland, you're as included and welcome as not.
Yeah. Noel, it's an interesting point Darren makes there. A united Ireland would feel a little bit further off after the last few days.
It certainly feels like there's an inflamed rhetoric around all of this, right? I mean, we've listened to a few contributions there where there's a lot of anger, I think, and there's a lot of anger in a lot of the columns today, and a lot of hurt there as well. So in that context, Brendan, it would seem as though if we're not able to fully embrace the past of the country, and if we're not able to embrace the diversity of what a united Ireland would look like, well, then prospectively, we do have problems ahead.
So should the president have gone then?
Look, the president made his decision for his own reasons, and I think he's outlined some of those. I'd like to see them teased out a little bit more.
Does the president make decisions for his own reasons, or does the president make decisions as the president? And if it's something like this that's going, potentially going to cause a big row, does he make them? You've hit
on the interesting ambiguity there, I think.
With the Department of Foreign Affairs.
Yeah, so I think it looks to me like he has made them for partially his own reasons based off his own beliefs, whereas others seem to be projecting perhaps that there's other reasons there. And I think that's one of the interesting elements to parse on this.
Can
right
we
now.
Not use the same argument that you're talking about there, that, you know, if everybody is moving on and being cognizant of everybody in this, that he actually does equally have the same right and obligations to say no to it. So it's like the default isn't turning up. The default is I can do one or the other and people will understand why. What we're missing is the entirety of people understanding why. So it shouldn't be that the default is that he has to go. The default should be he can go or not go, and it's not going to cause a kerfuffle.
Can I just bring back in Darren there? Darren, has this left a sour taste in Northern Ireland from people you've been talking to?
Yeah, I think it definitely has. The unions are pretty angry, I think, about this. And I think understandably so. I come back to the bigger picture point here, Brendan, which is essentially if President Higgins had have gone to this commemoration, this marking, you know, organised, it must be said, by the Catholic and Protestant churches. Let's not forget about that. You know, even something like that a couple of decades ago would have been pretty unthinkable in Northern Ireland. If he had have attended, would anyone have kicked up a fuss about it? I think not. I don't think even Sinn Féin would have made an issue about it. I think what President Higgins has done is he's got himself into an intellectual argument in his own head about, you know, words and the meanings and what may well have happened in the past.
Yes,
and
but in what? Fairness now, Darren, President Higgins, words are important and meanings are important. No, to him, he is in many ways, he is a symbol. So he needs to think about the symbolism of everything he does.
No, I quite agree with that. But my point is, I think he's had that argument in his head or with his staff. I don't think this is an argument that, frankly, actually many Irish people north or south of the border are having. And I think the bigger picture, greater symbolism picture of him standing, you know, next to the Queen in Armagh as an act of reconciliation with looking to the future of, you know, a unionist population who are understandably concerned about what a united Ireland may well look like, I don't think his decision has lessened those concerns. I think it may well add to them.
You see, and Darren, has it possibly revealed? I take your point that most people probably weren't thinking about this or anything, but is it what it has revealed that is interesting? Which, okay, and look, we won't take that Mail poll today as gospel, but you would get a sense that a lot of people do support him, and I certainly get a sense of the texters we've had over the weekend that a lot of people support him, 81% according to that. Is it what it reveals kind of more interesting than the actual fact of the president not going or not? And is what it reveals a bit depressing?
Yeah, I think it is a bit depressing in the sense that, and, you know, let's look at this from a unionist point of view. You know, if you're a unionist in Antrim and you're looking at the prospect of a united Ireland be a possibility in a decade, 2 decades time, you know, I think almost everyone accepts it's almost an inevitability. And, you know, you see these kind of nationalistic arguments flare up every so often. And this poll and this decision by President Higgins is a reminder that in the future, a bit like, you know, Catholics and nationalists in Northern Ireland in the past, will be a minority. And that clearly, obviously, is disconcerting. And I just come back to this point, like, President Higgins would not have lost any reputational he wouldn't have been damaged reputationally by attending this service. I don't think anyone really would have argued against it. He's made this decision on an intellectual level, which I kind of understand.
Okay,
but I think
we've got that there.
Really,
Johnny is gagging to get in there.
No, I think Sinead made the excellent point there. You know, look, this is about having the right to do it. And increasingly, when we talk about commemorations, and we do it as well when we talk about the royals, so it's not only about the president, we're talking about the royal family, this thing of putting pressure on other countries to vindicate our position or vindicate our thing. We shouldn't do it. Some people want to celebrate things, that's fine. Some people want to commemorate things, that's fine. Not everybody has to be part of it all the time. Not everything is quite as comfortable because it is more complex than that. But you know what? People respect more in any community when you stand up and are straight with them about what you do believe, either about the past or the present, and when you are willing to do hand in cooperation cooperation in the future and to work closely with people. That is what it's about. But I think we have to have that point of view where we say we respect someone's views of the past, whether they're unionist views of the past, nationalistic views of the past, doesn't matter. But we have to respect that. And it doesn't make a difference to our own positions that someone else disagrees with them. And I think that President Higgins, as a president, saw this as potentially heading down a difficult road, not just this event, but all the commemorations, all of the celebrations, all of the things we keep talking about. And I think he's brought an interesting thing to the table here, which is the right of heads of state or government not to continually try to revisit the positions of their parties or the people in them or their history or their grassroots or anything else, but to say, listen, we want to work in the future. This one, I'm just not sure about it and I'm stepping back.
Johnny,
no big deal.
You're an old political strategist now. If you were the strategist who has been asked to walk this line for the government today, who will presumably, I think they say they haven't had an invitation, presumably will be getting one post-haste, what should they do now?
I think, you know, for the government, it comes down to a question of what is their, where are they now comfortable at? Do they want to send somebody and are they comfortable with what this event may signify to anybody else? And look, at as Darren said there, I don't think there's going to be huge fallout if they send somebody. Equally, I actually don't
you
think
see,
unionists
there
are going to be impressed.
Been, but I think Darren is saying there wouldn't have been fallout if the president had quietly gone. There will be fallout now because this thing is now a hot potato.
You will have fallout, and you'll have fallout from these events, you know, that because the further they go on, the eventually you get into a situation where someone does attend something they shouldn't have attended or it's not precise to attend. But look, what should the government do now? The government needs to sit down and think, how comfortable are they with this? How comfortable are they with the powers that be in the north and where, whether or not this might inflame things or someone going inflames things or helps things, or is the event that important? But one thing I would definitely recommend to them is that they need to be a lot more cautious. This happened with the RIC stuff in Ireland last year. It happened with this. It is a complex thing, but we need to think about just, we're making stuff a little bit too solemn and a little bit too serious. And I think we're putting too much pressure on too many communities to acquiesce to one overall vision that everything's fine and forgiven. And we can't do that. We've got to accept differences.
Okay.
Can I just quickly add that? I mean, we have to remember Simon Coveney, when he was talking about President Higgins on Friday, was actually at an event in Belfast organised by the Presbyterian Church to mark the centenary.
Yeah, Darren, I think the difference is that it was an event at which people were speaking and they were maybe exploring it. Sinn Féin were at that as well, but they said it was an opportunity to talk about things. And actually, I read out some of what Simon Coveney said yesterday, because he talked about it, but he acknowledged that it had very different meanings and feelings for both communities. Darren, you're off to America now with Boris Johnson, are you? You have to go.
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm just about to hop on a plane. Yes, I'm going. Boris is flying over to New
York.
This
is work, I presume, not a pleasure. Yes.
It is work. Indeed. Yeah. So he's going to talk at the UN and then he's going to meet Biden for the first time in the White House later on this week. Of course, I suspect a UK-US trade deal not being on the table will be talked about, and Northern Ireland clearly plays a big part in that. We heard again from Nancy Pelosi, who's been in the UK, actually talking about how the peace process cannot be undermined trying to achieve a trade deal. So that, I think, will be on the table. And clearly this massive diplomatic spat with France this deal with Australia will be as well. So it should be an interesting trip. It's pretty clear, I don't think personally they're best of buddies or good friends. They're very different characters, clearly.
Yeah.
But at the
but
end of the day, the UK and the US have to get on.
Joe Biden did remember Boris Johnson's name at the announcement of the Australia-UK deal, which is
unlike Scott Morrison's.
More than can be said for our friend down under, pal. Okay. Well, listen, Darren, have a good trip. Darren McCaffrey, political editor at GB News. Thank you very much. Listen, before we leave all this behind, Noel, we were talking to John Bruton this morning and he says he's still hoping a way can be found to enable the president to go. He said that under the Good Friday Agreement, people accepted that Northern Ireland exists legitimately, so we should not be afraid to recognise their anniversaries. It's not to say you're accepting something is right or you believe in everything if you attend such an event. Is John Bruton wrong on this?
Well, I don't think anyone's denying the existence of Northern Ireland, first of all, okay? And we need to, I think, frame it in that context. I think Michael D. Higgins, as Sinead and Johnny have said, he's perfectly right to make the decision to not go.
And what do you think? What did you think about? I presume John Bruton is a political hero of yours in some way as a member of the Fine Gael family.
He's a former leader, Fine Gael, obviously. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, his opinion carries clout.
What did you feel about him coming out on this?
Of the whole element of this story so far, I thought one of the most unedifying elements of it was that kind of public spat. And that worked in both directions as well. Michael, the president, calling him the former Prime Minister seemed like a particularly loaded term as well.
of the Republic of Ireland.
We're all giggling at that. This could have been handled better. I think diplomacy is a fine art, and I think they could have found a way to speak to each other privately and confirm this.
That's why this, for better or worse, this event now has been politicised from all of the statements. So it's very similar to what Johnny said about the RIC one last year. What maybe were the initial thoughts or initial wishes of the people organising get changed by statements by politicians, and then they you know, grow different versions of themselves.
So we don't get to put our own meaning on an event. You put an event out into the world and meaning gets
conferred onto it. And that's exactly what happened.
Johnny, just to go back to that unedifying comment that Noel made there, John Bruton did appear to, I'm not being disrespectful to the president here, to suggest that his skin can be got under. John Bruton got under his skin, did he?
I think he did. And I think Michael D. Higgins is somebody who's, I don't think he would hide from that. And I hasten to add to this, I've never been a big fan of Michael D's, but, you know, he is one of these guys who I think...
Wash your mouth out.
I know.
There was a time you could have said that safely in this country.
You're extremely brave,
Jenny. Yeah. Look, there's
go back again to Pat Leahy yesterday. Never take on Michael D. Higgins because he's more popular than you, Johnny.
He absolutely is. And his two overwhelming, you know, votes in it. But I say that because that shows you the level of respect that I have for, you know, how he's approached this and why he does win respect. Because, you know, sometimes Michael D does get angry about things, and sometimes he does get fed up, particularly on social issues. And it's for those reasons that I respect him, even though, you know, I say from one side, well, I haven't always agreed with him. But, you know, it's from that. Now, I think the spat with John Bruton is particularly interesting because, you see, look, this goes into this political kind of thing. John Bruton has a history in his approach to Northern Ireland, which has always been from a side of, you know, look, when he took over as Taoiseach, it was, listen, we've had too much of this pan-nationalist front. I need to reach out to the unionists now. And he did that over, and we had...
And didn't Albert Reynolds once misspoke in an interview and referred to John Unionist,
John Unionist as a slip of the tongue, and that kind of struck. But, you know, John Bruton is... Now, to be fair to John Bruton, and again, you can criticise him for that, and you can criticise him from a nationalist perspective, but he had his agenda in doing that, and he did push things forward or try to... He was very effusive when Prince Charles came here, and he just has a reputation of John Bruton does believe strongly in the idea of being very proactive in reaching out to unionists.
In building bridges.
But there is another side of politics which says, you know, it is about sometimes not being, you know, letting people know where you come from.
And I think Michael D. Play to the gallery at home?
Not so much play to the gallery, but people need to know exactly what you're thinking of. I think, you know, distrust can equally be sown by somebody who is saying, listen, I'm on your side. And they're looking at, why would you be on my side? Why are you so all over me? You know, when, you know, you're not from my community, you're not from my background, why don't you represent the people you're from? And then let's all start from that point and we understand where we're coming from. And that was a big part, I think, in the original peace process was, you know, when people understand that, they understood where John Major was from, they understood where Albert Reynolds was from, and they were able to take opposing positions at times. It can get a bit confused when you reach too far across the whole, trust me. And I think, look...
There's John a great Bruton line in a TV show I was watching the other night when a woman of colour said to a white person, don't cry your white tears for my black pain.
Yeah.
Now, before all of this happened, we had a lot of politics going on and a lot of rancour going on as well. Noel, before we get to the papers, what did you think about the return of the Dáil?
In terms of going back to the...
In terms of the first session.
Well, I mean, it's obviously the Dáil is the home of proper political theatre. People are closer together. So obviously there was a bit more... how would you say, rambunctiousness, I suppose, than there had been in the National Convention Centre, where arguments literally got lost in the distance between people sometimes. The comments using Dáil privilege, I presume, is what you're alluding to on the question.
I think I'm alluding to what anyone there seemed to agree was a general atmosphere.
there was a rowdy atmosphere, all right. I certainly wasn't there, but it seems as though maybe, like with many things in life right now, Brendan, there has been an energy kind of storing up in people over the 18 months of COVID, and maybe that's the same in the political theatre as well. And it was sort of unleashed over the last week inside the natural Dáil chamber. Obviously, there was an abuse of privilege there, a prospective abuse of privilege there, which I presume there will be a complaint taken about that, or certainly that's the pronouncements that are being undertaken right now by the minister concerned. I can't really speak too much about that, but that seems to be where things are.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. What did you think of it, Sinead?
Yeah, I enjoyed your piece in the Independent today. Just kind of at that, I think a lot of people will be looking in, and I think this is probably a statement that you can make in any week in politics, but particularly the first week back, that people will be looking in and saying, oh, lads, get on with it. Like, people, I think, are angry about certain aspects of the Sapone thing, particularly the allegation of cronyism, but trying to, you know, weed out leaks, trying to weed out, you know, really finger-pointing blame at very tiny bits about text messages. And I think people are sick of that kind of messing. And I think the week, and then also adding into it the John Bruton, Michael D. Higgins row, it just all felt a little beneath what we actually need to grapple with in the post-COVID current housing crisis.
Absolutely, given the significance atmosphere of the gravity of the weight of the issues that are facing us. Normally, like, politics is meant to sort of go away for the summer to a certain extent. And like in Western Europe, right across Western Europe, you'll see a trend that government popularity tends to rise over the summer months as the parliaments rise as well. Mm. And it seems as though in this case, that simply did not happen. Politics really didn't exit front pages or front stages at all at any stage over the summer, which I think is unfortunate for the government.
Yeah, yeah. Was it Bertha from Bristol, or one of these women on Sky News, once said there a year or two back, people have had enough politics for now.
Yeah.
We didn't get our break this year, did we? Johnny, what's actually going on underneath all this? I presume you step back and see a bigger picture here.
I don't know. I don't know if you'd say it's a bigger picture or a smaller picture sometimes that you see when you step back. I mean, yeah, because as the guys, as Noel Sinead said there, yeah, there's a bigger picture of all the issues you've got to solve in society and all that kind of thing. That's probably a really big picture. And then you say this is petty politics going on in the background. Realistically, those big problems are always with us and we're always grappling with them, and governments are never kind of at ease. Where I see it from, it's just symptomatic of where politics is at. You've got three parties, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Sinn Féin, who haven't sorted themselves out from the 2020 election. They don't really know where they are. Two of them have got together and they hate each other. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael hate each other. They can't stand each other. Being in the same room as each other, they have to hold each other's noses and say, my God, get me out of here. And a couple of them are getting kind of nice and cosy at the top table, and that's annoying all the rest of the gang down there. The people on the grassroots out there, they're looking at local election seats and going, we're going to be wiped out here, lads. We're going to be destroyed. All of that is building up in this pressure cooker of a government, which is a government sewn together with the thinnest of threads, and everybody is pulling at it all the time. So it's not a strong government that can hold. You know, you look at the polls today, and all it tells you all the time is it's going to hold together because it's no option, because it's not looking great. Fine Gael are kind of having these little hits. They're not particularly popular. And remember, Fine Gael are really, to be honest, they're rubbish at elections. That's just quite a simple answer. Sure, you know, they don't win. They don't. They go into these elections, they should be winning them. They're out there, they have everything going for them in economies, and then they come out with these terrible results. Fianna Fáil thought that everything was going to be just gifted to them in the 2020 election. If you don't vote for Fine Gael, you have to vote for Fianna Fáil. Got a slap on the face. That didn't happen. Now those parties are looking at this going, Fianna Fáil are not in a position. They've come up a little bit in the polls, but they're not in a position to actually cause an election. They'd be terrified of the seat losses. Fine Gael will probably gain a few seats because it was so bad the last time. But at the same time, not good for Leo Varadkar. His ratings are down in the Mail poll as well. Leo Varadkar's going to say, listen, hang on in there till I'm Taoiseach, and then I can put the Fianna Fáil boys in order. And
Noel, do you think all of that does Leo Varadkar want to stay in politics? Because it's been floating around, and then we read in Hugh O'Connell's piece today that it was Michael Creed, I think, wasn't it, said from the floor at the thinking that the people at the top of the party, by which it is presumed to mean Leo Varadkar and Pascal Donoghue at least, need to commit to being there to the next election and beyond. Is there a disconnect now between the leadership of the party and between the grassroots and the backbenches? And B, is there that sense from what you might be hearing from old colleagues that people feel that Leo Varadkar and Pascal Donoghue are not fully committed?
I think the fact that Michael Creed felt the need to ask it as a question is illustrative of the fact that the question needs an answer. I think Leo did interviews with both Morning Ireland and with another commercial radio station where he said assured very clearly at the end of each interview that it was his intention to lead us into the next election. So, I mean, he has
answered
the question.
Where is this coming from then?
I mean, there's always going to be speculation about leadership in various parties. You can see the same thing in Fianna Fáil. To a lesser extent, you can see it in the Green Party as well. I think it is fair to say that obviously Fine Gael has had a difficult month, and if you delve into those polls there from the Mail on Sunday today, by and large the two Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil government parties tend to get between 39% and 42% between them. That's been the case for the last year and a half or so. But the difference with this poll is that the ratio is very much shifting back in the Fianna Fáil direction of the combined vote between the two. So that gives rise to a certain element of unease, I suppose, within Fine Gael right now.
Yeah, Sinead, it does feel like last week and possibly the week before, we were in here discussing, what are we going to do about the problem that is Fianna Fáil? And it's almost as if the media moves at such breakneck speed now that narratives have to move on. But they seem to have settled this weekend on what are we going to do about the problem of not Micheál and Fianna Fáil, but Leo and Fine Gael.
Yeah, and I think if I was a Fianna Fáil person, I'd be like, about time that we have managed to. Because if you were listening to Micheál Martin defend Simon Coveney, it's a terrible decision making around the Zappone affair. You would be wondering, especially if you were in Cork, what the hell is happening? So I think it is probably music to their ears that we are talking about Fine Gael and Shay. And one of the things that I wanted to pick out from Hugh O'Connell's piece that you mentioned there as well is that the rancour within Fine Gael also is Fine Gael people being annoyed at what's happening in Fine Gael, maybe not for the same reasons. So Hugh has a point that this week veteran Senator Paddy Burke at the Thinken was reported to have said he had no problem with Catherine Zampone getting the job, but asked why there weren't jobs going for Fine Gael people. So it wasn't exactly the alleged cronyism. The problem is that we're not doing enough for Fine Gael here. People, we're not doing enough
cronyism.
Cronyism, but not enough thinking about Fine Gael going on, which I think is where the questions are coming at from Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney and Pascal Donoghue. Okay, is there enough being done for the party? And I think that's what people in Fine Gael are asking, which is completely different to what people outside of Fine Gael are asking.
Totally. And while I certainly wouldn't ask where are the jobs for the Fine Gael people in terms of the reorganising and the rebuilding of the party, because Fine Gael obviously had a very bad election in 2020, and I'm one of the beneficiaries, if you like, of that bad election in a way. There is a question mark over, has the organisation really reflected on that election? Has the organisation really recovered from that election?
And the suggestion in that piece is that part of the frustration within Fine Gael is that none of them, including Leo Varadkar, wanted to go into government. They wanted to go in and rebuild. Mm-hmm. And you can't rebuild when you're in power.
Yeah, historically, it just has not happened in any party in Irish history, really, that you've been able to rebuild while in power. So, I mean, there are difficult challenges ahead. Now, that said, you have to obviously consider that the last year and a half have been virtually impossible in terms of time management for Leo, Pascal, Simon to focus on the party. Perhaps 2022 will bring more time and latitude to be able to do that. But right now, obviously, their job has been looking after their respective ministries. And I think that's fair enough.
Who picked the Alan Shatter piece? Is that you, Johnny?
Yeah. I thought it was
just it's an interesting little sidebar to all this.
It is an interesting sidebar because, of course, Alan Shatter, you know, prominent minister, prominent figure within Fine Gael, and, you know, we all know the circumstances which he was forced to resign for the sake of the government and everything else at the time. Alan Shatter's written today that Fine Gael has lost its dignity and its sense of honour. And he's talking about his own experience and that how he was exonerated by investigations and how, you know, his Fine Gael colleague said to him, yes, well done. And Simon Coveney,
he publishes in that piece in mm-hmm. the Sunday Independent a text from Leo Varadkar and text from Simon Coveney saying, you know, we roughly speaking, we stand by you
and all that.
And then contrast that with public utterances are he does say Leo Varadkar was quite supportive at times, but that the public utterances were at variance.
And here's the difficulty when you're in politics. Like, you know, I have some sympathy here for Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney in this, because yes, on a personal level they probably do feel, but then they feel, can I get this argument across in the public, or is it worth having this argument in the public for Fine Gael's sake, for the party's sake? And inevitably you tend to come back and go, no, we need to move on and get on to other other things. Yeah. Alan's our mate, but we're not here to defend Alan. There's a party, there's a bigger thing. And that's the problem they've had. But, you know, it's an interesting timing because these things are all beginning to stack up and catch up with Leo. And there's a perception that maybe he isn't interested in being a typical Fine Gael leader. I think Noel makes a good point. Hard to rebuild. There's no chicken and chips circus during COVID. You can't go out and do the dinner dances. You can't go out and bring the grassroots together and tell them I'm interested. That's always hard in government anyway. But there is this growing sense that, look, you know, and it's a narrative, and it's one Leo Varadkar has to be very careful of, because it is a narrative that Leo's not fully committed to being a politician, that maybe he doesn't like the job, maybe he'd like some other job. And if you get that sense from a politician, you won't vote for them. You're going to vote for someone who doesn't really want the job. And that's a problem for Fine Gael. It's a problem within Fine Gael at the moment. I think if he allows that to gain any kind of traction, it's going to catch up with him really quick. And there's a lot of people, the longer you're in government, the more enemies and the more people are out there willing to give you a little kick every so often.
Sinead, and again, it's a kind of a related note here. Gerard Howland in the Sunday Times, you picked out.
Yeah, because he's talking about that piece in the Mail on Sunday last week, where a lot of Fianna Fáil TDs were hugely criticised and mocked, really, for what they were wearing and what they looked like, female.
For which
male.
Now the Mail have wholeheartedly, and the journalist has today. And I let's not get into beating up on her. People write columns, and sometimes, you know, you want to be edgy, you step over the line. I think it could happen to a lot of people.
And I think most people will be happy to have seen, if they haven't seen it, the Mail did put in an apology. Yeah.
But I think it probably speaks to something broader.
Yeah, Howland does. And this probably speaks to some of the Leo Varadkar stuff as well. When we talked in the last couple of weeks, and there was a letter written to the Irish Times about his privacy and whether he's entitled to his privacy if he goes to events like festivals in the UK. But Gerard Howland is talking about kind of that uniform that we make people wear, that like being stepping out of that uniform, there's an insidiousness that we are kind of allow each other to body shame, to slut shame, to fat shame, and kind of these are all instruments of our othering, and that really is at play, I think, in politics at the moment. That while that column was an extreme element of it, I think we do see it come into play a lot within politics, males and females. It's obviously worse for female politicians, but we do see that come in, and it is, I think, in 20 years' time, we will be looking back and saying, did we make politics actually too difficult to get into for the people who are talented enough for it?
And the thing that struck me was, you're not allowed to talk about celebrities like that anymore. And they all have millions of quid to insulate them against the hurt and everything. But they're all victims now if anyone says boo to them. But politicians, it seems, are, Noel, do you feel you're there to be kicked around?
Yeah, a lot of the time you would, and you'd feel like there's a different standard in a very negative way applied to politicians relative to other public figures, perhaps, where it wouldn't be acceptable to comment.
You found that yourself,
absolutely,
didn't you?
Absolutely, yeah. On a regular basis, you'd find you'd find comments about your appearance. Can't remember any newspaper columns that did it, but certainly Twitter, social media, definitely there would be a deep level of that. You'd find even journalists would pass comment on what you were wearing in and out, because I would have been a relatively informally dressed member of, as far as Fine Gael go anyway. So you'd find comments there. I'd obviously have a skin condition, rosacea, which people would absolutely comment about regularly as well. So yeah, there can be kind of hurtful comments kind of kicked about the place.
And
all right.
One of the points that Howland makes is that a lot of the reason why we all have insecurities, and I think politicians probably aren't allowed those insecurities. I think for some reasons they can't have them publicly around decision making. But if we are doing it when it comes to, you know, things like skin conditions or people's how they look, that then that's where we're completely on the wrong side of it.
Yeah, I think so. And like, one of the comments that I get regularly, I suppose, levelled at me from members of the public nowadays is just, they see stories like that story last week, and we won't dwell on it at all, and they just think, you know, why on earth would I go into politics? Like, I want to serve my community. I don't want to be having shots taken at me all the time.
And you see, then that brings us back around to Leo Varadkar could presumably make, at this stage now, 10 times what he makes at the moment and avoid all that scrutiny and everything else.
Like, I mean, yeah, you don't, I think you go into politics for maybe more altruistic reasons than perhaps the narrative has often been.
I
think
people, but does anyone believe that?
I don't know, but like the talk is always Merck and Perks and this, that and the other, but I don't necessarily think that is the case. It's a difficult job.
Okay, we'll take a break. Johnny Fallon, Sinead O'Carroll and Noel Rock staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back. Johnny Fallon, Sinead O'Carroll and Noel Rock are still with us. But now, the headline on the front of the Mail on Sunday today is bosses should be told about unvaxxed staff. And again, in their poll, people overwhelmingly think they should be. Breda O'Malley is head of employment and a partner with Hayes Solicitors. Breda, according to this survey, 74% of people back employers' right to ask for vaccination status. How big a problem is this going to be for companies as people go back to the office tomorrow?
Good morning, Brendan, and thank you for having me on the show. I can only speak to it from a legal perspective, but I can say that I have some sympathy to employers in this situation. Looking at it from an employment law perspective, I think employers have been placed in an unenviable position. Obviously, the context, as you mentioned, is the opening up of workplaces tomorrow, where employees that haven't been essential in the workplace are now gradually being allowed to come back. But from an employer's perspective, they have obligations in legal terms under health and safety law. They also have obligations in respect of data protection law. Employers have to provide a safe workplace. They have to protect the safety and health of the employees, that's whether they're vaccinated or not vaccinated. And we all know from what we've seen over the last 18 months that the relevance of vaccination is key in that. I mean, we have seen the different pattern of what has happened in recent months since the vaccination rollout, and that there aren't the same needs for the traditional measures that we associate with COVID-19, such as the social distancing. And you can imagine from an employer's perspective, trying to get its cohort of workers back in, not knowing if they're vaccinated or not, well, is left with no alternative but to facilitate social distancing. And that means really reducing numbers back in, continuing to have the costs of rent, etc., and having a number of employees on a remote basis. So it's far from ideal.
And is there an answer, Breda?
Is there an answer to it? Well, there is, if there's a government willingness in it. And I suppose we can't neglect the employees' imperative here as well to have freedom of choice around health issues. There's sometimes a religious or a health imperative as to why somebody hasn't been vaccinated.
So how do we balance
it out? Race pieces. The only way that I can envisage from a legal perspective that it can be balanced out is if the government introduces legislation. We've seen that they have done it by making an amendment to the health legislation, introducing the digital COVID certs for use in bars and restaurants. That could be extended to the workplace generally, or it could be extended at least on a sector-specific basis where there's a particularly high risk of transmission. So I think there are ways and means to relieve employers of the conundrum that they're facing from tomorrow.
Yeah. Now, I'm hearing of various creative wheezes in different companies to get around kind of trying to, that, like, very elaborate schemes to try and ascertain if somebody's vaccinated. I presume you've heard about these as well, yeah?
There's several of them. And to be honest, they've been ongoing, not just in recent weeks, but really right through the COVID situation, because as we know, many of our frontline workers have been in the workplace and employers have been trying to manage around that situation.
So what kind of stuff are people doing?
I thought it was an interesting one that I heard of last week. I'm not going to promote it as legally compliant, but I noted as just something that has been heard in passing, where basically you'll be aware probably of the UNICEF laudable incentive around get a vaccine, give a vaccine, where, you know, a contribution is made towards a vaccine for people in underdeveloped countries, etc. And I know of some employers that are asking their employees to let us know if and when you've been vaccinated so we can make the contribution on your behalf to UNICEF. So that's perfectly legitimate to do that, and a fabulous thing for an employer to do. But if in turn the employer then goes on to use that information to organise the workplace in the context of returning to work and determining, or will we have masks, will we have social distancing, in light of the information they learn out of their charitable efforts, that's a misuse of data. So it's not legally appropriate, but I do know there are many different creative solutions being arrived at by employers. In fairness, as a way of trying to find the correct blend in this.
Yeah.
But the legal framework isn't there to support them doing it in a straightforward way.
Okay, well, Breda, you've blown that wheeze now anyway, one way or another, by talking about it on the radio. No one's going to get caught now. Breda O'Malley, Head of Employment Law and a partner with Hayes Solicitors, thank you very much for that. This is a tricky one, guys, isn't it?
It's a really tricky one, especially when you read of like employees having problems. So even not even getting to the employer level, that employees have problems with each other if they ascertain that someone who sits next to them isn't vaccinated or is very virulently anti-vax. So I think that's probably where employers will start seeing actual real problems if there's, you know, arguments on at the water cooler.
Yeah, and we read in the Sunday, and there's a piece of another employment lawyer saying that there's a situation developing where people are refusing to talk to unvaccinated people on anything other than strictly on work matters. And
now,
stuff
we probably shouldn't overstate it.
Are you back in the office in the Journal? Or?
We're not yet. And we probably shouldn't overstate this too much. Like, there was very little vaccine hesitancy here. You know, over 90% of the population are vaccinated. So it won't probably happen in every workplace that these things will arise. So hopefully we'll talk about it more than we actually see it.
Okay, listen, I did want to get to something else because, Noel Rock, you're featuring in the papers today. And Johnny, you had actually picked out this piece in the Business Post about lobbying. So just tell us the broad sweep of it first, and then I might ask Noel about his own experiences.
Well, the broad sweep about it is that it's effectively saying it's a grey area, that if people don't know exactly what constitutes lobbying, then do the lobbying laws actually work? And the piece centres around this idea that, you know, look, lobbying has rules that you have to declare. So if you're lobbying a politician, and I want, so if Noel was a TD and I walk up to Noel and I say to Noel, in the upcoming bill, I think you should vote for the following amendment, and I want you to, that's clearly lobbying, and I'm trying to tell him you need to vote for this, or you need to change this part of the legislation. Now, as a lobbyist, I then go off, and as a lobbying register, and I have to type in my details on that, it's online, lobbying.ie, and I put in there that I lobbied on behalf of a client. All seems perfect. But then there's a whole other area that, do you know, when if I go to Noel and I say to him, by the way, I just want to let you know a couple of things that are upcoming in world affairs that are, you know, going to affect Ireland. And you should know, is that lobbying or is it just a chat?
And we're back to Simon Coveney, who didn't feel he was
being lobbied. He didn't feel he was being lobbied.
Feel you're being lobbied. Are you being lobbied? Noel, what I was kind of amazed about in this piece is that, now, you did take a kind of sabbatical or whatever of 8 months, but you have now set up a kind of a lobbying
public affairs consultancy. Yeah.
There's no cooling off period for you as an ex-TD, is that correct?
No, that's right, Brendan. And it probably is one of the ambiguities
that's
that you might look at.
Isn't it?
It for ministers and for junior ministers, there is.
And for special advisors.
Correct,
like,
for special advisors,
there are
also.
For a year or whatever.
Correct,
yeah?
There's a cooling off period of 1 year for special
advisors. But you
advisors.
Can walk out and the next day you can go back.
Theoretically, yeah, one could, a backbench TD could. And I was kind of surprised to realise that myself. it was March 2020, so it wasn't exactly the most lucrative time to walk out and start lobbying people. But there are some things in the legislation that probably could be amended and fixed to a certain extent. In terms of declaring lobbying, it's in the eyes of the lobbyer, if you like, rather than the lobby recipient.
Okay, so if you don't feel you're lobbying something.
Yeah. Okay. But again, if you get the grey area, no.
If you're around the block enough, and politicians like Simon Coveney, like what they feel or what they don't feel, they know if they're being lobbied for a job. Yeah. They know if they're being lobbied. They know if, even if I haven't been told which way to vote, like by the nature of the chat you're talking about there, you know if it's lobbying
But it's not down to them to decide if it's lobbying. We now realise it's down to the lobbyer to decide if he's lobbying or not.
That's one of the tricky aspects of the legislation. Legislation's pretty old at this stage, and it probably does deserve some updating. The European Union would have, in the Parliament there, would have a lobbying register of their own. It's interesting that it's quite a bit more comprehensive. You have to declare who all your clients are. You have to declare exactly how much, well, not exactly, but roughly how much you're paid by each client.
Okay.
That would seem like a road maybe worth exploring in terms of updating the legislation.
Okay, listen, we've 3 minutes left, and I do want to touch on something that there's a good bit in the Business Post about it, and Matt Cooper's talking about it and stuff. And I think it's fascinating in the sense that it kind of deals, Sinead, with class, and certainly if you come from Cork, this is all about about class, right? And this is the America's Cup. But on the other hand, then it deals with, I suppose, this new notion of that the elites, you can't do anything elitist because we should be building social housing or putting it into health or whatever.
Yeah, and it's interesting to tie back to the other conversation. The Irish Times managed to find someone when asking them about Zapongate, and she said, "I don't care about Simon Coveney's text message. He just should be off going and getting the America's Cup for Cork." So there are a lot of people, and actually the Sunday Business Post have a lot of businesses particularly who want the America's Cup to come to Cork. Organisers say the yacht race is the third biggest sporting event in the world after the Olympics and the World Cup. Now, I would be very dubious about that. It depends on the metrics. It does go on for a number of months, and the actual race itself goes on for a number of weeks in Cork.
Yeah, so kind of years, it
seems
to be.
So I'd imagine if you cumulatively, if you add up all those months and races and years, that maybe that's how they get it, rather than a 4 week or 2 week condensed event like the Olympics or the World Cup.
And there seems to be a suggestion in the Business Post that basically Ireland tried to say no. and as George Costanza memorably said in Seinfeld once about a girlfriend, she's not accepting my breakup. That we tried to say no by making an unreasonable demand that they wait 6 months. And they said, well, look, we'll wait 2 months. Nola, do you know anything about this?
Well, I mean, it kind of resembles, I think, how we used to keep winning the Eurovision back in the day and then kind of couldn't get it off our desk. That seems to be the case in New Zealand, where you win the right to rehost it again if you've won it in the past.
Do you win the right to decide who gets to do it next? So it's kind of back to pass the parcel,
Exactly.
But the figures then vary wildly. It could cost 150, but 100 of that is infrastructure that we want anyway, and we could make 400 million,
But now there's a secondary report in addition to that first report that says that maybe the cost is actually between 200 and 400 million euro, and suddenly the ratios then of cost to benefit are suddenly thrown well out of kilter. So, I mean, there's a case there to be made for just a bit more further analysis and a bit more time to be taken on.
But also, we know that none of the reports after an event ever correlate with the pre event. So,
everything in Ireland costs way more than
intended. And every sporting event always costs more than intended. Look at Tokyo, just gone in 2020, and that wasn't even just COVID overspend.
They should just host it in Longford. That's my only thing to center.
Okay, Johnny Fallon, thank you for that. Sinead O'Carroll and Noel Rock, thank you very much.